Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, squids and croissants, entities individualized and localized here and now in the timeline in your socks. Welcome. We're going to be talking about love. We're going to be talking about intent. We're going to be talking about safe attachment. We're going to be talking about alchemical processes for overcoming pain and for overcoming trauma. The first thing I need to cover with you, though, is this week in the community tab, I asked a question about what video you guys would like to do next. So people were able to come up with their own video title, and then based on the vote that it received tonight, which is now, whichever got the highest vote, that's the video title I'm going to do next. So the winner of that one, with 183 likes at this particular moment in space and time, was a chap called GW, who question was, I've been targeted by so many narcissists and socio-psychopaths over the years that I'm absolutely mystified to understand the question, do they think they are normal, inverted commas? How can they possibly go through life completely unaware of their malevolence and cruelty? I'm absolutely 100% not paranoid. I know this, largely by discovering these videos and learning that these disorders are a thing. I just can't believe the scale of it. Is it possible the species has been driven collectively insane in some way? So I will be doing a video titled something like Narcissists or Psychopaths or Narcopaths, do they think they are normal? Thanks to everybody who contributed to that. I wanted to start out with some paranoid conspiracy theory. Oh, let your tin hat shine. Your tin foil hat shine in the light of the moon. I suspect that what has happened, and there's the new video that's coming out that I did with PRXO will not be in the Alchemy and Intent series. I actually wanted to cover a style of propagandizing of a people that I think was developed in the Soviet regime in Soviet Russia and perfected there and then practiced throughout the countries where communist rule took hold after World War II. And it was very much about breaking the human spirit. It was very much about finding an efficient way to do warfare. And I think some clever person in Russia figured out, somebody in the Stalinist regime, not the dissidents who were, not the Russian dissidents against the Stalinist regime, but somebody who was pro-Stalin, who was using their mental capacity for their intelligence for evil ends, figured out that when you're in a war, you can shoot the enemy. You can shoot more of the enemy than they can shoot of you, and then you win. What do you do if you don't have weapons? What if you have a scenario, as the Russian army did, where there were not enough weapons to go around and not enough ammunition to go around, and they were simply ordered to charge the enemy, the Nazis in this case, the Germans, and to wait until their comrades fell around them, and then to pick up the rifles that their comrades were holding to then continue the charge? Some intelligent person said, yes, you can kill more of the enemy, but what if you simply convince the enemy to never pick up a weapon and fire it in the first place? What if you break their spirit so that they don't fire at all? Flash forward a few decades, and I think that you have a scenario in the Western world where another bright person, or bright people, also using their intelligence to evil ends, figured out that the major threat to the government, to the people in charge of the nations in the West, was no longer external, was that they had the chessboard locked up. They had such powerful agreements and such powerful technology and militaries that the chessboard was completely locked up, and that their major threat was now their own people, a population that was exploding, but whose energy, resources, children, and taxation they needed. So they didn't try and curb the population, or at least not at that time. What they wanted to do was to try and find a way of getting people to submit. I think that they waged a war on love. I think that George Orwell's 1984 was a warning from the inside. It was a warning from someone who knew what the agenda was. That was written in 1948. And there is a very strange passage in there where O'Brien says to Winston, O'Brien is the representative of the party. He is the representative of Big Brother and is torturing Winston. And he says, we will abolish the orgasm. We will abolish love. Remember in the story in 1984, Winston is caught and captured for a sex crime. He had sex with a girl that he liked without a license. They had to leave the city. They thought they weren't being watched. They went to a farm and they had sex, and that was his crime. And you say, well, there's no war how can you say there's a war against sex or they're trying to abolish the orgasm when there's so much pornography? Ah, but we know the people who've misused Freud's insights know very well that if you flood the environment and flood the culture with sexual imagery and with pornographic imagery, actually what happens is that people's sex drives go down. They're less likely to crave sex with each other because A, they're being satisfied in other ways, and B, you're setting a standard of sexual performance that most normal people just can't attain to. So they feel bad about themselves, they develop body image issues, and it's very hard to be physically intimate with somebody if you're riddled with body image issues. And we're constantly being bombarded. If you go through any city, anywhere in the world, even in Asia, even in Muslim countries, you're bombarded with sexual imagery. I'm not a prude. I'm not that guy. I'm not like, hey, you should do all that stuff down. It's bad for you. But I do understand the effect that it has long term over decades on people's self-image, on their capacity to be intimate. So I wanted to open this up by saying that actually, I think we live in times where love itself has been controversialized. To controversialize something is a known tactic. If you want to silence somebody, sure, you can hang them, though you can cause them to hang themselves in a cell where it would be rather hard for them to hang themselves. You can cause them to commit suicide by shooting themselves in the back of the head 3 or 4 times. You can cause them to slip in the shower and bump their head off every sharp surface in the house on the way down. Or you can just take them out by making it so that nobody will ever listen to them again. That's called controversializing someone. That's how when you want to get rid of a person, you controversialize them. If you want to get rid of a behavior or a process in a culture, you controversialize it. How can we say that love really now has not been controversialized? How can we say that sex has not been controversialized? I talk to people younger than me about people in my age group don't seem to really care, but people younger than me, the digital natives, are now terrified of making a mistake in the realm of their own sexual behavior because they have seen other people being dragged before a Stalinist style court, being dragged before a new inquisition, tortured, and then being technologically controversialized, which is what we now call deplatforming. There's a terror of intimacy, a terror of love, a terror of even forming friendships with people. It's very hard. What does that do? It creates this tide of loneliness and of isolation. People walk around saying that they feel anxious and depressed. I don't believe them. I don't believe them. I don't think that they know what anxiety really is. I don't think that they know what depression really is, but I believe them when they say that they're in pain. They don't have the language and they're not trained to think in terms of just saying, oh, I'm in pain. So they'll say, well, what's the language that I've heard other people use? Everybody else is saying anxiety and depression. I'm going to say anxiety and depression as well. But really, they're just in pain. Why are they in pain? I think because they're feeling lonely. I think that we're feeling very disconnected from each other. And it's an enormously painful experience to be disconnected with each other. People are frightened of making connections. They're frightened of walking over to another human being and saying, hey, I am currently in the Czech Republic. I have come to Prague to do some work with Pierre XO, who lives in Prague. I've never really spent much time here before. The communist regime fell, I think it must be now 30 years ago to the day. Today they are celebrating the Czech Republic Independence Day, independence from the communist regime. It's only 30 years since it fell. And you can still feel the effect. People here are terrified of being seen. They're terrified of being heard. I just spent 3 hours taking a bachata seminar, which is a dance class that requires men to assertively approach women and then lead them, the bloody patriarchy of it, lead them, disgusting, sexist, barbarian monsters wanting to dance with a girl. It's a bloody outrage. I felt my blood pressure go down. And it's very hard. It's very, very hard because for them. Because of this culture that grew up where you clearly people are struggling to be seen. They struggle with being seen because if you were seen and you stuck out, you would be hammered down. And even if you weren't an adult in that period, you were raised by parents and family units who behaved that way. So even without the stimulus, you would just model that behavior as well. Intimacy in this context has been intimacy expressiveness, the rights of the individual in this context have been observably fractured. There's a famous structure here that's been put in place as a commemoration to the victims of the communist regime in the Czech Republic. And it is of a human being being slowly fractured, being slowly pulled apart from his self and slowly being burned through, which is what oppression eventually does. So I actually think that we live in times where love itself is under attack, where intimacy is under attack. So if you're single and you don't know why and you're feeling bad and you're not sure what's going on, just realize that it's not necessarily you. We have the psychological terms. There is something called counterdependency. There are attachment disorders, but you live in a highly propagandized, highly brainwashed society in which even as you're interacting with other human beings who want nothing more than to connect with you in a way that is meaningful, they have been brainwashed and conditioned, as have you, into being terrified of the vulnerability and intimacy that would allow love. There can be no love without intimacy. There can be no love without vulnerability. And we live in a culture of posturing and narcissistic and psychopathic levels of intimidation and signaling. It's a very aggressive, very not physically violent, but emotionally violent culture that we've developed around us. And in that culture, you have to be very tough and very strong to simply ask for what you want and to form intimate bonds with other people. So it's not all you and it's not all psychology. I think that this is way beyond that. I think this is a philosophical problem. I think it's an ideological problem, but it very clearly is a major problem. I will now take questions for the rest of this hour. Please make them one sentence long, have them end in a question mark, and make them relevant to the subject. It would help me massively. Kimberly. Hello, Kimberly. Good to hear from you. Yes, fear of vulnerability and virtue signaling. It's not just virtue signaling. Virtue signaling is a big part of it, but signaling. So instead of communicating, we've been conditioned to signal. Signaling has taken precedent over communication now. Teresa asks, how do I get out of this mindset? I think the first thing to do is to become aware of it and to admit to yourself that there is a mindset there that is impacting the way that you are thinking about love and thinking about intimacy. And it's making you and others hostile. It's making us all hostile to each other, because we've been convinced that everybody else is the enemy. All the other human beings in the environment are our enemies. They're not our brothers and sisters. But when you crack the carapace, the shell, everybody's the same, man. They're frightened, they're vulnerable, they're extremely lonely everywhere. Everywhere, people are extremely lonely and they're desperate for some genuine human contact. Is loneliness part of the human condition? It certainly is. It certainly is a part of the human. Are we going to descend into a more fractured society? If we don't say no, if we don't say no, and we don't say stop, and we don't start doing something for ourselves, first and foremost, then absolutely, absolutely, we will fracture and fracture and fracture further and further. And the road that we're on right now is not a good one. Emily Jane says, it's so sad that real love relationships have become a rarity. It is indeed. Robin says, in the short video, you mentioned our relationship with some parts of ourselves becoming schizophrenic. What did you mean? Schism is a gap, and it's a non-integrated, in the sort of Jungian and psychological sense, it's a non-integrated split between different parts. What's happened is, because we're living in a new orthodoxy now, we simply cut that part off of ourself, which is called splitting, that is not acceptable to the superego. So our superegos have been hijacked. The superego is the part of your personality that checks your value system. The vibe checks you if you get carried away and start doing the wrong thing. It says, no, we're not allowed to do that. Superego can be benign, or the superego can become toxic if it's propagandized and brainwashed and conditioned into toxicity. So what we're living in is a time when the superego is trying. It's being hijacked. Nobody asked you. No, you didn't give your consent. The superego is trying to aspire to a level of purity and an orthodoxy. I'm not going to go too far into that because I'm doing other videos on it as we speak. And you can see it. You can see the effect. I mean, look at the effect of what's happening in the world just of stand-up comedy. Look at what's happening on university campuses, where people who in other times and in other places should be permitted to speak are simply being shut down or even physically attacked. That is an anti-intellectual act. Purely and simply, it's an anti-intellectual act. What motivates people to behave in such a base, hypocritical, anti-intellectual way? They're trying, or rather their superego is sending them an injunction that what is coming in is unacceptable and is a virus. They're not strong. They're not boundary. They're not thinking, well, I know. I'll debate with anybody because I'm like, well, I know what I believe. Maybe I could learn something by chatting to you. You're from a different perspective. Let's have a conversation and see what comes from it because I'm confident. I don't start screaming, covering my ears, rocking and going, yeah, 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 yeah. Don't let any of the bad sounds in. That's not a rational response, nor is it a confident response. So it's schizophrenia. It's a schizophrenic relationship that we have had forced upon us with ourselves. We know, and yet we do not know. It's Freud's fetishist split. We know that we're being told things that are plainly and simply not true. But we're told if we don't voice the same bullshit, then we are bad. We are sinners. We have failed. We are dissidents and we belong in a gulag. And we fear now, we're terrified of the technological gulagging that awaits us if we do not toe the party line and kiss Stalin's mustache. Amanda says, I've actually experienced an increase in sexual hostility and violence from men since feminism has demonized men. Why do you think this is? I think that hostility breeds hostility. It's quite simple. Violence breeds violence. Hostility breeds hostility. And feminism, in its essence, is a fundamentally toxic ideology, unfortunately. It alleges to be about something called equal rights, but unfortunately has spent an awful lot of time indulging in what I suspect is collective trauma-based misandry, which is misogyny is when you hate women, misandry is when you hate men. They've permitted themselves the indulgence and enjoyed it. You know, they've enjoyed the misandry. Okay, fine. But at what cost? At what cost? So yes, if we demonize a group of people, if it happens to be men, they'll respond with hostility. What happens when we demonize certain ethnic groups? They get pissed off and they respond with hostility. There's been the Stanford prison experiments covered this in the realm of psychology very well. They showed that if you treat people as though they are wretched and criminal and aggressive scum, then they respond as though they are wretched and criminal and aggressive scum. It's just the way it goes, man. It's just the way it goes. That's human psychology for you. So if you treat men as what's the standard definition or the standard worldview of men? Psychopathic, predatory sex robots with no emotions who care about nothing but sexual conquest. It's fundamentally a projection of toxic masculinity. I personally believe that the toxic masculinity that the feminists talk about is their own toxic masculinity. They are the ones who have the toxic masculinity and it's a projection. How could a woman be toxically masculine? Well, if we take the Freudian concept of animus possession, we can say that these people are clearly possessed by a toxic ideology. They've pushed away certain parts of themselves. They split off certain parts of themselves and those parts of themselves have come back to repossess them. Animus possession in women is where the benign yang, masculine or animus is mind, rational elements are pushed to one side. So instead of being noble, instead of being assertive, they get repossessed by a male spirit, if you like. It's psychology, so forgive. It's Jungian psychology, so I'm going to use these words because it's easier. They're repossessed, they're not possessed by a male spirit. It's not a spirit. It's the masculine part of yourself comes back and takes over. But you're then taken over not by like a really nice, noble man. You're taken over by this childlike version of an evil man, a dark, violent, you know, conquering, mindless, marauding soldier, you know, one with no honor. And so that then gets projected outward and manifests in the world as a masculinity that is doubtlessly toxic. But I think, not that toxic masculinity doesn't there isn't, it doesn't occur in men. But I think the obsession with it is a projection. The Ancient Lantern says, the more extreme feminists are reacting with hostile masculinity and people are shocked because they're not used to women behaving with this kind of hostility and anger. Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately. Richard, are you Jewish? I don't think so. Not that anybody's told me. I think I'm mainly Irish, according to the last DNA test I did. I'm an Irish Slav with a bit of English. Women demonstrate the most aggressive, unboundary behavior of men. Yes, as UG Rose. It was actually UG Rose from Brooklyn who taught me about animus and anima possession about 18 months ago. Yeah, it's. But again, you know, if you make people feel alienated, or if you tell them they have been alienated, if you make people feel less than, or you tell them historically they were made to feel less than, rage is the inevitable response. And if it's repressed, it kind of leaks out as just this constant, you know, passive aggression, unfortunately. Okay. Individual treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder using Mantram repetition, randomized clinical trial, is an interesting article on PTSD online. Thank you, Warristar. If anybody has any questions, if you could write them now, end them with a question mark and make it relevant to the topic, that would be great. Pamela Kay says, I raised the boy and I'm completely appalled by this toxic masculinity. I personally believe that it's exactly as Richard says. Zizek was talking about it recently, talking about the American Psychology Association, not the American Psychiatric Association, who released a paper, I think, earlier this year, maybe it was the end of 2018, talking about some masculine behaviors, going, those masculine behaviors, they're toxic and we need to train them out of men. And it's this controversializing of love, controversializing of intimacy, controversializing of sex is now being taken further and further. They've wiggled in. It's like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. You move in. You don't go for your hold straight away. You just creep forward. You're grabbing the gi and you're like pulling in. And your opponent doesn't know what you're doing. You're wiggling your thumb around the back of his collar to get that choke. And they're slowly, slowly wiggling in. So now what are they trying to do? They're trying to controversialize men. Being a man ultimately will be a crime. We've already controversialized a lot of masculine traits, but ultimately being a man will be a crime. What will the end result of that be? No sex. No sex. No polarity. No sex. No masculine, feminine. No sexuality and no intimacy. Even within same-sex relationships, you have masculine and feminine polarity, and people play within that polarity. You know, as a heterosexual guy, I play within the polarity that I work in. I work as a coach. It's a very yin. I hold the space for people, and I accept them, and I listen to them. You see me a lot in like talk mode. This is masculine. The finger comes out. Here is my phallus. I point it at you. You listen to my words. And because of the setup, you can't say anything back. That's social media's works like this. So you can write things back, but you can't say anything back. But in other areas, I could be playing with my 2-year-old nephew, and I wouldn't be in this emotional state because it would freak him the fuck out. You need to be in a much more gentle state. So if we start going, okay, how do we break the system? Make everybody meet in the middle, make everybody meet in the middle, make everybody neutral, put everybody there. Everybody who is too far there or too far there is there. Make everything on one side of the seesaw wrong. Everything that's on one side of the seesaw is wrong. It's all bad. It's all mental illness. That's a frightening place to have gotten to. That's, you know, adults in rooms, intelligent people, doubtlessly intelligent people with letters after their names saying that certain elements of humanity that are natural, naturally occurring elements of humanity are now unacceptable. They're now to be considered insane. If you read the paper, it's extremely distressing because they give advice on how to recondition boys, how to recondition young men, not only to recondition them, and I'm not making this up, this is the language these lunatics use, to recondition them so that they become allies. Did any of you study feminism academically? I did, as part of my degree. I was in there at Aston University, over there in the sociology section, looking up feminist texts. I studied it. I didn't mind it. I thought it was all right. I thought it was a good bit of like social deconstructionism, discourse analysis. I thought it was bright stuff, man. There was questions being raised that were valid. This is back in 1996. Little did I know quite where it was going to lead to. I mean, you have people now ranting against postmodernism, and I'm like, whoa, it's just a way of seeing things. It's really just, it's like there's modernism, which is talking in absolutes, and then there's postmodernism. Why is everybody getting so angry? Why do you have to pick a side? Why do you have to be either like a modernist or a postmodernist? Can't you just pick postmodernism up? Which I thought you could. When I was 19, I was like, well, I was using a bit of Skinnerian behaviorism, a bit of Jungian psychoanalysis, a bit of sociology from over here, and I might use a bit of postmodernism to do a bit of an analysis. No, you can't do that. It's wrong thought. These are thought crimes now. Dreadful, dreadful thought crimes. Remember, though, when we're talking about a culture that's being traumatized, what is one of the classic responses to trauma? Splitting. What is another classic response to trauma? Black and white thinking. So it's an infantile defense. You're either in this team or you're in this team. It's like, why is there only two teams? When is there ever two teams? I was listening to two philosophers argue the other day, and they were talking about two paradigms. And then I got in the shower and I was like, why is it always, there's two philosophers talking and they said there's two paradigms. Why is it always two paradigms? Why do we always choose two? What's magic about two? Two. Why is it always two? On the one side and then on the other side. I was like, oh, because when I gesture with my dumb fucking appendages, because I'm not a squid, I have two of them. So everything becomes two. So we organize our world into two. But if we had three appendages, it would be three. And if it was five, it would be five. It's just that. That's why it's two. Stupid. I can't prove that. That's a dumb hypothesis that I came up with in the shower. Repeat that. Other than your degree from Grabbler U, why do you feel that you can give advice to young men on taking the right path in life? My degree was from Aston University, and I don't feel that I can give advice to young men on taking the right path in life. Margaret Kempton has asked me, does this mean that in this age, sensitive young men will be attracted to being non-binary? Like I said before, I think what everybody is going to try and do, and if they're sensitive and they don't want to hurt anybody, then where our superego is going to send us injunctions that try to force us to toe the line, the party line of purity. It's an orthodoxy. We live inside of an orthodoxy now. So if you go outside of that, you are either, you can call it a dissident, you can call it a sinner, you can call it being unclean, whatever you like. So everybody's really trying to avoid being daubed with red paint and being like, look at this one. We caught one. It's a witch hunt. So if you're hammered with the message that the safest thing to do is to be non-binary, and your character is one that leans towards withdrawing from danger, then yes, absolutely, sensitive young men would be attracted to being non-binary. What do you think about the work of David Icke and Jordan Peterson? I enjoy listening to them both, and I've learned a lot from both of them. And I don't agree with everything that Mr. Jordan Peterson says, but I've been vocal about that on this channel. I've already talked about where I disagree with Jordan Peterson. But you know, he's a really, really intelligent guy who has an awful lot of insightful things to say about psychology. I'm just not sure I agree with the conclusions he comes to. David Icke, I think the first time I picked up a David Icke book would have been in 1995, before I even went to university. And over the decades, I'm bothered by just how often he's been proven right. If you listen to his most recent talk that he did on London Real, which is freely available on YouTube, you'd be surprised. The guy does a lot of research, man. Can you tell those who don't know about your adult pill? Yeah. This came from, I did a talk for a Red Pill convention, and I wanted to offer what I hoped was, and I believe was largely received as, constructive criticism of this false dichotomy of blue pill and red pill, and I said that I didn't buy it. I didn't buy the idea that men can be reduced to being red pill or blue pill or alpha males and beta pills, males. And I said that it was childish and infantile, and that what they needed was an adult pill. And I think that got like a pretty long and hard round of applause. People liked it. So yeah, that was the adult pill. Are you aware of any studies on cluster B personality and MDMA or psychedelics? I am afraid MDMA has been used in studies to deal with PTSD. No, of it being cluster B personality per se. Any American Gods fans? I love how the series give a face to modern gods and ideologies. It's cool, very cool. I was about to click somebody and it disappeared. So those of us that meet someone and truly fall in love is by chance. Well, what does truly fall in love mean? Beware, my friend, beware, because I know I go on a bit, but what I'm trying to convey is that we live in a time that's infected with an ideology that isn't orthodoxy, and it thinks in childish and extreme ways, and it demands that we think in childish and extreme ways. What does truly fall in love mean? It sounds to me like a magical and binary state. This person did not truly fall in love. They artificially fell in love. They're living a lie. These people truly fell in love. I'm afraid that in my life, I've never seen one shred of evidence, nor could I give you one example where that mode of thinking holds up. Everybody gets through it in a relationship. Everybody who's in a long-term relationship that I know of gets through it. And they get through it by to varying degrees of happiness, depending on different factors like compromise and clear communication and expectation. And I think the idea of salvation through falling in love is a poisonous one, and should be let go of post haste, because it really, really is going to hold people back. There's no salvation through another human being. Nobody knows more than you. And you coming together with another human being isn't going to elevate you out of this plane of existence. I'm deeply sympathetic to people who do want to elevate outside of this plane of existence. I mean, for me personally, looking more at the Gnostic texts, the Nag Hammadi texts again, and the worldview of the Bogomils, I would say if you're a sane person, you would see that there seems to be something wrong with this like plane of existence. Yeah, there's something not quite right here. And to want to improve it and to elevate beyond it makes sense. But the idea that you would do that through falling in love, I think, is a really dangerous trap and really keeps people very, very miserable, because they think they're failing. They think they're failing to do something that everybody does. Some part of me wonders if the myth around just falling in love and being happy forever and ever through the other, through another human. I mean, I know humans inside out because it's been my job for years. It seems to me to be faulty, but I do wonder if maybe like one in 10,000 people or something, they get together and they are such a uniquely good fit for each other. I wonder if that's a possibility. But even then, I would say that isn't truly falling in love. There is no truly falling in love. There's just people. There's just people, and that's okay. That's totally fine. I mean, you can be in love with somebody, but don't think in terms of falsely falling in love or truly falling in love. Or perhaps it would be more useful to think of there's people who force themselves to act as though they've fallen in love, and then there's people who haven't. Maybe that's more useful. How do we train our subconscious to feel worthy of love and connection? The training of the subconscious usually falls in line with repetition, and it tends to respond well to imagery and metaphor. So if you were doing a lot of affirmations repetitively, and I do mean like several times a day for 30 to 60 days, and visualizations repetitively 4 or 5 times a day for 30 to 60 days to start seeing results, that were around the theme of being worthy of love and worthy of connection and worthy of being seen and heard by another person, that's the kind of thing I would do to train the subconscious for. That is an interesting comment. Salvation through falling in love is asking the other to heal your past, expecting the other to give what was not given in the early years. Yep, definitely. You just took the torture out of love. Good. Well, that was useful. It was worth showing up for. You can take the torture out of it. It's a good idea. What did I miss? I just got here. Did he say anything profound? yeah, probably in the first tier since then. You're kind of wasting your time now. How do we reconcile profound loneliness with profound fear of intimacy and abandonment? Well, probably worth listening back to what I'm saying now. Not, I'm saying a lot, so there's no way all of it is going to go in the first time around. You have a task ahead of you, because it's not just you. The point that I made in the beginning is it's not an individualized psychological problem. It's a group problem, and it's more at the level of ideology and philosophy and the whole worldview. So you feel lonely. So you start like the most human way possible. You say, I feel lonely. Yes. Okay. So that's the radical acceptance. That's the humility to say, yes, I feel lonely. I'm experiencing a profound fear of intimacy and of being abandoned. Okay. So also the humility, the human side. I am experiencing profound fear of intimacy and abandonment. And all of this is natural. And so does everybody else. Name a human. They experience or have experienced profound loneliness. Name a human. They're dealing with profound fear of both intimacy and of abandonment. It's a conundrum for humans to deal with. It just happens to be a particularly bad time that we've gotten to in our history, in our story. It's a particularly aggravated issue. It's always been an issue, possibly always will be an issue. You know, you grow inside of another human being and you're part of them, and then you become separate from them. And that is like root trauma. Apart from when the Anunnaki left us here. Why did you leave, Daddy? Come back with your big, weird alien head. I'm not sure what love is anymore, because the feelings of being in love is just like a drug, which leads me to believe it's toxic, and which I still crave that feeling anyway. How could I deal with this? Well, becoming emotionally literate is going to help you, and developing a strong philosophy in life will help. You know, you need a strong moral philosophy. And by that, I don't mean you need to squeeze all the fun out of your life. The opposite, you need to get as much fun in life as you possibly can. That is a prerogative. That's a primary objective. But whilst having fun and enjoying yourself and contributing and making other people laugh and having a good time and connecting with friends and growing as a human being, in order to navigate away from danger and towards safety and happiness, you do need a system. You do need a value system, and you do need your own personal moral code. If you can see that you are addicted to the feelings of lust, limerence, of being desired, of desiring another, you know, it can make us feel young again. It can make us feel excited. It can make us feel giddy. And if you're susceptible to that, particularly in a relationship context, I would say, hey, what's wrong with feeling young again? What's wrong with feeling giddy? What's wrong with feeling excited? Nothing. But maybe let's find another way of doing it. I dance around the flat and sing songs in my pants. I'm actually going to do a demonstration of that in about 5 minutes. I didn't say the pants would be where they should. They're on my head. I do it on my head. You could do whatever you want, right? You could put pants on your head and dance around. Don't do that. Don't do that. It's like people say, like Richard Grannan told somebody that they should put the underwear on the head and then flop around break dancing. That's not what I'm saying. But you can do other stuff that allows you to attain to those feelings. You want to feel excited. You want to feel good. You want to feel motivated. Get your life in order. Get things sorted out. Life should be fun. If you're essentially miserable, you're not enjoying your job, you don't like the way you make money, your friends are downers, you don't like the place you're living, that's what you should deal with. If all you're doing is trying to bring another person in to clump up that wound and to make you feel better, it's doomed, man. It's really doomed, because you're in a state of toxic passivity. I'm not saying this is you, questioner. I think your name was Amanda. I'm not saying this is you. I'm talking now generally. You're not happy. Like you just go, I'm just not happy. Okay, I'm not in a good place, and I'm trying to get another person and bring them to where I'm at. So what are you offering them? You're not happiness. Well, that sounds like a shit deal. You know, if relationships are your bag, and relationship is a big priority for you, it might not be for me. It might not be for other people on this channel. You might have different prerogatives. I might be in a place where I'm like, I'd rather form a circle of good friends first and foremost. I'd rather have better relationships with people in my family or whatever it is. It could be that. It's knowing what you want and then setting the intent towards that and then moving towards it and just asking for it and just going, yo, this is what I want. This is what is fun for me. This is what is exciting for me. But if I was going to try and to get into a relationship, I would remember that I need to be feeling good. I need to be content, because what I'm bringing the other person into is into a reality tunnel of contentment, a reality tunnel of good stuff like happiness and feeling good. not I'm drowning, you fucking save me because I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna be a downer, man. Put pants on. How can I find, well, how can I find a psych therapist that actually understands narcissistic dynamics? Been to see a few specialists, you don't get it. If you, in your country, wherever you are, if you look up a counseling directory, if you're in the UK, you can look up counseling directory online. Check their tags. They make it really easy. Some people say that they understand narcissistic abuse to get clients, and then when you speak to them, they actually don't. And then just do a little interview with them first. Have a little chat with them. If checks can't lead in dance, I went to two classes. Let's not go too far with the conclusions of one man. I mean, if this was a psychology study, they'd be saying to me, listen, lads, you need to do a larger group study than that. Due to past communist regime, which is what I said, it might not be true. Why can Ukrainians and Russians still do it? I don't know. I've not danced with any Ukrainians and Russians. Are you saying that they can? It's just a different culture. And also, you would need to understand the history of communism in Russia did not, and for the broadest element of the communist, of the Russian people, did not match the experience of the Czech Republic in any way, shape or form. It's a tricky issue. I'm much less confident pontificating about it because it's politics. But what is clear to me at this point, and I've spent years trying to wrap my head around it, is that when we say the word communism and when we say the word Marxism, it means a lot of different things in different contexts and to different people, right? In the Czech Republic, the way it played out is we've got what seems to me to be a nation of people who are very, very, very muted and struggle to be seen, to be heard. Spasibo, Davidish, for your question. What's your advice on the correlation between today's subject and long-distance relationships? My long-distance relationships? I don't know, man. I don't want to upset people. I'm not a big fan of the long distance relationship. I think if you've got an established, I mean, you know, what does that mean? There are people who say they're in long distance relationships where they met somebody online and they never met them in the real world. And I'd be like, how long has it gone on for? 6 months. I'm like, never meet them in the real world then. Just keep doing this if it's working for you. If you were with somebody for 10 years and then for a period of time you had to be apart, I would want to know how long you're going to be apart for. And how far away you are from each other. We need to be realistic in terms of understanding what two fragile, needful human beings can endure and for how long. It's. I'm not saying it's impossible. I would say there's a slightly low-key, L-O-K-I-ish, chaos-inducing element in me that wants to say, there really is no such thing as a long-distance relationship. That's two people who are just kidding each other. That would be unfair. I will mute that impulse because I think that that's unfair. I would, however, stand by the idea that a lot of people do kid themselves in relationships. There's a lot of people who are just living a total fantasy. There's a lot of people who kid themselves in relationships with themselves. I mean, if you go through the comments here, you'll not particularly in this chat so far, but in some of the chats I've done, you'll get people going, oh, not me. None of this applies to me. If you're on a higher spiritual wavelength, this doesn't apply. I'm like, well, why are you fucking here watching my dumb YouTube video if you're on a higher spiritual wavelength? So be careful and don't expect too much. Humans are just you. They are weak and fragile, Davidish. The ultimatum, go along with this or else you're a bad person. You can just say no, says SM Widge. You're not a bad person. It doesn't make any sense. This is a fallacy that keeps people pitted against each other. The inability to say no is a key element for Gregory Bateson's double bind theory of schizophrenia. You have to be in a situation you feel as though you can't. Heavens, Carly says, learning your government doesn't give a shit about you. Is it really that hard? They do care about you. Taxes, enslave your children. Were you able to find love and a relationship after what you have been through, says Gray. Yes. You're asking me, is there hope? And am I a shining example of hope? You can definitely love again. You can definitely get over. So some of the things I've mentioned are like feeling heartbroken with humanity, that such things even exist. You can definitely get past that. You can definitely love somebody again. You can definitely form loving friendships with other people again. and you can have a relationship as a recovering fawn responding codependent. I am absolutely 1000% certain that the most important relationship I can have is with the person who's talking right now. And that's not easy, because he's not easy. Like, people are complicated, but I wouldn't be looking to, you know, fulfill the societally approved, rubber stamped, you know, be with a girl for the rest of your life and make genetic replicas of yourself paradigm right at this particular point. I think I'm doing really well, and I don't want to change that. There's a whole thing I need to do, but it will be after the end of this year, which is not that long now. Get ready for Christmas, kids. About 2019, which was my effort, I set an intent this year to overcome codependency. And I was talking about this on an Instagram stream last night. Like, I think I did, but not completely. And I think some of the things that I've developed overcoming codependency in myself, I can't transmit to anyone. I'll be able to tell you the story. I'll be able to tell you what happened. I'll be able to tell you what I did, but I don't think there'll be like a course with steps in it. Like the CPTSD thing, I can give you a structured course and go do, 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 do. You will reduce your emotional flashbacks to nearly zero. You will be able to deal with the superego issues, and therefore you've overcome PTSD. Codependency. Codependency is a whole other bag, man. But I am, as it were, dating. The flip side of that question is, you know, from where I am, because I'm in a very unique position. Sounds narcissistic. Well, perhaps it is in like the benign Freudian sense, like in terms of the development, you know, healthy narcissism. I don't know many people who are in my position. I don't know a single fucker who's in my position. Not one. Not one person can I look at and go, I think they're where I'm at. And I appreciate that privilege of the uniqueness of my position as it relates to relationships and love and everything else. And I'm like, I kind of feel like maybe I should stick with this for a period of time and see what comes of it. The other side of your question, perhaps I would never go for the what should we call it, the picket fence fantasy. There's no instinct in me to do it. There's none. Where there was before. So when the person asked before is, what about when people truly fall in love versus falsely fall in love? You know, there's those of us out there who are trying to make love happen. Match.com, I think, is the biggest dating site in the world. And their slogan is, make love happen. And that's very interesting. Can you? Can you make it happen? Can you find out what my, you know, cultural, ethnic preferences are? What I would like in terms of education and IQ? What I would like in terms of interest, and then just stick us together. Can a computer do it? Could a really intelligent, you know, some amazing like quantum supercomputer artificial intelligence do it? Maybe, or maybe not. And so I'm not in a position where I'm like, fuck, I wish I could just make love happen. But I must tell you, I have been in my life. I have been. And I'd say that with no shame, because I look at the timeline of my life and I go, well, at that age and in that place, if I did have a girlfriend or wife and a steady relationship, my life definitely would have been better. Sounds incredibly non-romantic of you, Richard. Well, I tend to think, or I try to think as a recovering codependent, in non-romantic terms about this issue, because it's such a triggering issue. So I did want it. So why? Well, because life would have been better. Aha. So what are you saying now, that life wouldn't be better? And I would say, I don't know. So then, philosophically, me to me, is that why you wouldn't want to do it? And I would say, no. If I actually just met somebody and fell in love, at this point, I wouldn't be doing it because it would make my life better. I would be doing it because I'd fallen in love. That's a different thing. And some people will be listening to this going, what fucking waffle is he coming out with now? It's a world of difference. They're two different quantum realities. In one, you're trying to fix a problem and you're trying to pull a person. You have a job open. You're a corporation. You have a job open. I'm really looking. We have this role. We're calling it boyfriend. And like, so it's snuggles. And, you know, you're going to help me with the rent. And, blah, 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 blah. And then you list all this stuff off. And you want it. And in another reality, it happens. You don't make it happen. It just is something that is there in your life. And if it is not there, there is no wince internally of any kind of sadness where you go, okay, I'm going to live the rest of my life and not experience that. If you don't flinch internally at all at that prospect, then you're in a different reality tunnel to everybody else. And you guys say, that's incredibly arrogant. Loads of people feel that way. No, they don't. They simply don't. It's not true. It's a lie. Most people are desperate to be in love. And that is a big part of the problem because they're bringing the energy of desperation into that space. And desperation and love do not mix well. Desperation and safe attachment do not mix well at all. Abandonment, anxiety, manipulation, control of the other, bringing your resentment from your last girlfriend, your last husband to this relationship. And you go, I don't do that. You do. You do. But you do because you're human, same as me. And that's what we do. We're not that wonderful. You know, we have our blind spots. We have our dark spots. We have the shadow elements of ourselves and we have the monstrous elements of ourselves. And we're living inside of our projections to a certain degree. So that can happen. It's a really, really good question. One that everybody who's watching this should ask themselves, like, what's the point? Like, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to be in love because you think that being in love will improve the quality of your life? Just answer the question. Because there's no condemnation with that. I would say, well, so it's not like you're trying to drown kittens every day. You want to be with a person, you want to be in love, and you can see that it would make your life better, and that's fine. But please be able to hold in the same space the simple truth that that is a really different reality. There's only two realities because I only have two hands because I'm a hominid. And that there's this one, I want to make love happen. And in this one, I'm like, Mushin, Zen mind, Mushin, no mind, Mushin. What is it? What do you have for me? And that is hard for women who come to like talking to me because I'm like, Mushin. Like, okay, well, what is it? Well, you know. No, I don't know. You tell me. What is it? What are you looking for? Why are you making just, you know? I haven't watched a romantic comedy in years for it to fill me with its ideology so that I can know. I need you to be an adult and to look me in the eyes and tell me what it is that you want. And nobody's been able to do it so far. But hope springs eternal. See me on Instagram around the Christmas tree. Nice Christmas jumper on. Some dogs, some kids, and some shiny presents, eh? Oh, Richard, why must you ruin people's dreams? I'm trying. They're hard ideas. I'm trying to help. I'm trying to, because look, it's only a YouTube video. So I can only sort of give you a different perspective and a different flavor. So I've just put a flavor that in a certain space where that flavor doesn't normally go in there. And it's kind of like a lot of you will be like, ugh, this is fucking, what the fuck? How do I feel about this? Let that continue. Let it roll around inside your head. Wrestle with it and see what comes out. JB says, yes, love equals make life better. What I really need is a man with a snowplow and car repair skills. Me too. Where are all these good snowplow driving men? I will make him cookies and contribute skills I am good at. Lol, I'm kind of serious. Yes, me too. Show me these good men. Simon says, please check out Facing Love Addiction. It's a good book. Yuji Rose says, your dream is inside, not models for you to fit into, for agreement. Jeff Watkins says, only a YouTube video? Knowledge is power. You are right, Mr. Watkins. You are right. I think what I meant is, like, I mean, even if this was a seminar and we were sat face to face, it's when people are listening to me or when I'm listening to somebody, I can't ingest everything that they're saying. They're going to say something. And I'm probably like, I listen to Slavoj Žižek. I'm probably hearing about 40% of what he says. And the other 60% of the time, I'm like, what do I think about what he said? I'm just, you know, realistic about what people can take in. Oh, dear. Now, Joe, what? Come on now. Richard, there's loads of lovely women out there to fill you with. I don't want to be filled. With joy and butterflies. Keep the faith, everyone. Mini nanny noo, mini manny, bibbly bibblingtons, unicorn farts, and biscuit-bearing bears. Kimberly says, this is giving hope. I'm seeing new paths. That is my intent. That is my intent. But not to give you like that toxic hope where you don't take action, you just sit there and hope. But you go, huh, you know, I'm trying to alter your map. I'm trying to just do a little alteration of the map. So you go, oh, okay. So you just shift things around a little bit. Stevie Bananas says, I don't need someone to share my life with. I want someone to share my life. Okie dokie. So I think it is nearly time for me to GTFO. I'll take a couple more questions and then I will try and be useful, and then I shall simply go away. But it has been fun. If you could make them one sentence long and end in the squiggly question mark thing, I will have a go at them. I'm ready. Let's go. Muay Thai music begins. Cat stuck in a fax machine. People who don't know Thai music will be like, what the fucking hell is he talking about? What is he on about? Oh. What to do when happiness is a trigger? Well, thank you, PGTTMCR. What you can do is go over to spartanlifecoach.com and join my mailing list there, and you will be given a free course. It's a free book, video, and audio course on how to reduce your emotional flashbacks so that you will not be at the mercy of such triggers. How do you get the questions onto the screen? I'm in charge of that. So you can't do it. I just have a thing. I'm using StreamYard, so I can select to have questions. Have you ever studied Tibetan Buddhism?
Yes.
I would love to know how not to cut away people too soon. Take your time. Be patient. Do you have any tips for overcoming fear of intimacy? Yes, I gave them earlier in this talk. I suggest that you develop some emotional literacy. I have a course for doing that. If you want to take the free version, you can go over to my Instagram, which is at Richard Grannon, all one word. And on my Instagram, if you scroll down to the bottom, you'll see these colored boxes. And in the center of the page, one of the colored boxes says start here. And if you go in there and swipe left, it gives you a free course on developing your emotional literacy. I recommend that you do that so that you know what it is you're really feeling. You might not have the fear of intimacy that you think you have. You might just have some other emotion there going on there. Okie dokie. Jesse, what did Dr. Peterson get wrong?
Well, it depends on what you mean by wrong. I mean, it's all a value judgment, really. I don't know. Well, you just got to pick up your bloody burden and make your bed, eh? You bloody well get on with your suffering.
What did he get wrong? I'm finishing soon. Can I do a whole video on that somewhere else? I think every time he talks about subjects that he hasn't researched properly, he's making a mistake and he devalues his genuine value. He has genuine value. I mean, he's as in the realm of psychology, he really, really has a lot to say. He flounders and makes big errors when he moves into mysticism and philosophy and politics and economics, simply because they're not his fields of study. I give you figure one, the discussion with Mr. Slavoj Žižek, which was not really a discussion, where it was clear Mr. Peterson doesn't really know what the word Marxist means. He doesn't really know what postmodernism is. And it seemed to me that he didn't really know who Slavoj Žižek was. He himself admitted that he was surprised to find Žižek calm, jokey, who would listen. He's a rational guy. And I'm like, Jordan, did you even bother to watch three videos on the plane flying to the debate? It was an enormously, it was arrogant. It was an arrogant thing to do. And it was a mistake. He also, in that debate, he was speaking in defense of capitalism. And I go, if somebody's going to speak in defense of capitalism, why him? It's not his field of expertise. But other than that, there are various mistakes and errors that he's made that I could get into, but I won't because I want to finish now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for your time and for your attention. I realize this is a challenging topic. I'm really impressed by the comments that came through. They were mature and thoughtful. I hope that I have helped you to think about this in a way that is perhaps a little more clear. That was my intent, was to offer you a different way to think about this in a way that would be useful for you, would serve you. Non-servium, right? We don't want to be at the effect of a toxic ideology. We want to start developing our own moral philosophy and reclaiming our sovereignty and our agency and living our own lives in our own way. Thank you all for your time and your attention, and I look forward